You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
14 Mission 2, San Jose Avenue.
From our 901 Mission Street studios, you are listening to the San Francisco Chronicle.
Welcome to Movies with Mick LaSalle on the Datebook Podcast. I'm pop culture critic Peter Hartlob here with Mick LaSalle. Welcome.
Oh, hi, Peter. It's good to be here.
You know, you talk a little bit about Doris Day today, and advanced obituaries came up. Without saying who you've written obituaries about already that are in the can, can you tell our audience a little bit how advanced obituaries work at a newspaper?
Well, I won't say who I've done advanced obituary for, but they generally tend to be people who are about 85 and up, because even if they're in their 70s, you know, they can go another 20 years, and what we need... But of course, people surprise you, you know, like, you know, things happen. But generally, I probably have about seven or eight in the can. And we, when Liba was out of there, we would do them whenever Liba saw somebody on TV looking unhealthy. And that would be the occasion for it. My greatest nightmare is to end up like Mel Gusso or Vincent Canby, who in the New York Times, they keep on writing obituaries from the grave because they died and then the person died. And I got very paranoid about that about 10 or 15 years ago, I guess, because I wrote about Bob Hope when he was 95 and he didn't die. He just kept on going and going and going. And then another one was Ronald Reagan. I did Ronald Reagan as a movie actor. I did Ronald Reagan, and I think he went on for another 5 or 6 years.
Wow. Well, that's a... I'm speechless, Mick. I usually am not. I'm just going to let our audience know that you talk a lot about Doris Day. You get in an awesome rant about 84-year-old Judi Dench, cast as Shakespeare's 50-something wife in All Is True. We talk about John Wick 3. Thank you for bringing me back on.
Yes.
And another lesser-known action film in theaters right now, My Son, is it?
Yeah, My Son. It's a French one. It's pretty
Garçon.
Good. Mon Garçon.
Mon Garçon.
Yeah, my boy.
Datebook Podcast, thanks for listening.
Well, hello, everybody. This is Mick LaSalle, and welcome to Movies with Mick LaSalle. I am here with my former editor, Liba Hertz. Hi, Liba.
Hey, everyone.
So this week we have some movies to talk about, and we have some movies to talk about from other weeks, because we haven't, I think we haven't had a podcast in a few weeks. But I wanted to start off by just acknowledging that Doris Day died.
Yeah, she was 97, I believe.
She was 97, because they finally confirmed as of a couple of years ago that she was born in 1922 instead of 1924. Mm-hmm. For a while, she was under the impression herself, genuinely under the impression, not trying to lie about her age, that she was born in 1924. And then she found out otherwise in Liba's like weeping over here, by the way. I just want to just tell you, Liba's looking at me, there's something in her eye or something, and she's weeping, and she's giving me like these facial tableaus. She looks like Falconetti in The Passion of Joan of Arc over here. Do you need a tissue or something? All right. Well, as Liba goes off to get a tissue, I just want to say that this obituary, just for those of you who like to know how the sausage is made, was actually written, the what appeared in the Chronicle was actually written in 2014 at Liba's insistence. She said, she's 90 years old, that's what we thought at the time. She was 92, actually. And she said, you know, it's time we wrote something. And one of the things that I just wanted to say about Doris Day is that I think to some degree, she has been rehabilitated and kind of understood critically. But there was a time in the 70s where Doris Day was misunderstood as being corny and as saccharine, and her reputation artistically was very much put on the road to being rescued by Molly Haskell in her great book From Reverence to Rape, which was published in 1973, I believe. And that's a great book. It's called The Treatment of Women in the Movies. And she said that actually Doris Day was kind of a feminist heroine. And that changed critical thought around Doris Day. And that a lot of the actually making fun of Doris Day was kind of misogynistic. It was a kind of, I think it was a kind of resentment actually of her, the competency that she always showed on screen. And a kind of, didn't really need the guy. But, if the guy was around, that was good. And when I wrote this, I'm very much following in the example of Molly Haskell, who I have enormous respect for. I wrote it with that in mind. And I was interested to see that many of the obituaries that were out there really didn't talk about her as kind of a feminist heroine, but sort of like talked about as kind of old fashioned. And of course, everybody's a product of their time, and or at least everybody is forced to be a product of their time by their time. And she was making movies in one of the worst periods of the 20th century for women in terms of their depiction on screen, the 50s. Which was kind of a combination of prurience and Puritanism. But even within that, I think that she was a great example of on screen of a woman who, had it together and could function. And of course, in real life, she was anything but this kind of, boring, virginal presence the way she's always talked about. Also, too, I think if you really want to hear Doris Day, listen to her big band singing from I guess the early 40s when she was very young. I mean, her song, her first hit, which is the thing that where she became known nationally, was "Sentimental Journey" with the Les Brown Band, and
Les Brown and his Band of Renown.
Les Brown and his Band of Renown, and. Have you ever, you've heard "Sentimental Journey"?
Yeah.
It is such a sexy, insinuating vocal performance.
I'd sing it, but I'm sure I would get massive protests.
So. Well, yeah, and it's
not
just
because,
hard
because
to
me,
do it. But she sounds really like this guy is going to be like, when this guy gets home, it's going to be great. Or when she gets to where the guy is, it's going to be like, this guy has something to really look forward to. She really, she was able to present just vocally a side of herself that she didn't really get to present in movies.
Is her role in The Man Who Knew Too Much, is that the only Hitchcock heroine to actually sing a song as part of the plot line as well as just singing the song?
I don't know.
She does the Que Sera,
she
Sera.
Sings it over and over again.
And,
it really is too much.
It's just sort of, if you take it into context with the movie, I know there was just before she died, somebody had just seen the movie, I believe at the Castro or the Stanford Theater, and complained about how awful it was. And there was a bunch of us saying, no. Think about what it was doing, and giving her a major role with Jimmy Stewart in that type of, like you said, the feminist role that you didn't even think about.
Well, the thing I like about that movie is the way they kind of depict a completely dead, destroyed marriage. I mean, he drugs her without telling her. He's a real hard guy. There's something very unsentimental about the presentation of that marriage. That marriage is finished, mm-hmm. basically. And the only thing holding them together is the kid, and then the kid is kidnapped. I think that's a good movie. I used to say how great it was, and I saw it recently, and these things all are subject to change, but I think it's a good movie, but that too much Que Sera, Sera, I have to say. By the way, on the obituary, as it appears on the sfchronicle.com, we don't even link to her. We actually have on the obituary at the bottom, there's an interesting appearance
of Doris Day on the Johnny Carson show in 1974. Did you see that, Lena?
I don't see it. No, I didn't see the clip.
Well, you really, you get to see like the career she might have had, or if she was making movies, if she was like 15 years younger, so that she was making her movies in the 60s and 70s instead of the 50s and early 60s, because she is really cool. She's 52. She looks just beautiful, and she's dressed in a way that's a lot more revealing than anything she ever wore in the movies. And she just, and she has such authority. She just is really cool. And then, of course, I guess you have to mention, right, the animal stuff.
The animal stuff. Oh, she was, you know, big on the animals. But I was, like, thinking, like, early on in her movie career, she appears in this movie as a secondary role called Storm Warning.
Yeah.
And in the movie, it stars Ronald Reagan and Ginger Rogers, and Ronald Reagan is fighting the Ku Klux Klan, or what would be the fictional name in the movie, and Doris Day plays Ginger Rogers' sister. She's married to an abusive husband, takes all this abuse, does a really good acting job, and she gets killed, and it's the only movie she ever gets killed in.
Yeah, this is like in the period where she started, she was only in co-starring roles very briefly, but it was also in that period that she made, I think, Young Man with a Horn or whatever, whatever the movie, I forgot, is that the name of it?
I think it's Young Man, that's about Kirk Douglas.
Anyway, Doris Day,
and the other thing is that we just have to mention, her comedies also get a big, you know, at the time, everybody joked about, you know, her Rock Hudson, Doris Day comedies. And if you go back and look at those, hold up very well. And even me, who everybody knows doesn't like the Yankees, there's a scene in the movie, I forgot which one it is, but all of a sudden she's found sitting in the dugout with the Yankees. And I mean, you're talking Mickey Mantle and Roger Maris, and she's sitting there with them, kind of looking baffled, and it's a very funny little scene. And Tony Randall's was a co-star in some of them, and
the only thing
it's really good comedy.
I saw Pillow Talk recently, and it's better than what I said it was in 2014 in the review, but you know, it's not enough to make me go say, oh, I got to rewrite this. Yeah. It's a pretty good movie of its time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The thing I find utterly fascinating about the movie now is watching the scenes between Rock Hudson and Tony Randall, because it is the ultimate meeting of a gay-seeming straight man and a straight-seeming gay man. I mean, if you had watched that movie and you said to people in 1961, okay, one of these guys is gay, which one is it? I don't think most people would say, oh, it's Rock Hudson, unless they knew something. And so it's really fun. And of course, they even in that movie have Rock Hudson making believe that he's gay at one point. It's just so weird. I wonder what was going on in his mind. Anyway, so, you know, as they say, so much for Buckingham and Richard III, so much for Doris Day.
And we should also, you know, give a shout out to a TV star legend. Tim Conway passed away as well. Famous for being one of the sidekicks was Carol Burnett. And I think probably the one that broke her up the most. She would be doing a scene and supposedly straight faced, and he would just either hang on or do something absolutely crazy. And she just couldn't control herself. And as a result, it made everybody laugh even more and more.
I think they tried to laugh. There's a certain point where trying not to laugh becomes not funny because you think they're maybe even trying to laugh. I don't know.
She was good at it.
What was wrong with him?
I was 85.
No. Aside from that, I mean, what was his illness? Do you know?
No, I don't know what he died from. He was appearing a few years ago. He was appearing in I think he appeared, as a matter of fact, as a guest star in Hot in Cleveland with Betty White.
Okay.
And of course, that also had Valerie Bertinelli and Wendy Malick and I can't think of the third. Other one, Jane Leaves. I remember they all showed up. All the Carl Reiner showed up as a guest star. Tim Conway. So
yeah. Anyway. Also, since we last spoke, in the podcast, my old boss Bob Graham died.
Yeah.
One of the great guys. Just a terrific guy. I'm wondering when I see Peter, I'm going to ask him if he knew Bob Graham. I have a feeling he knew him a little bit, but not that much. Anyway, let's talk, Liba, about some of the movies that are opening this week. So let's see. Well, for example, there's this one, maybe that one you can ask me about. Yeah, that one.
The movie Trial by Fire.
Oh yeah, that one.
Is that the Clint Eastwood movie?
Trial by Fire. Do you know what this movie is?
No, I think I read your review and I forgot all about it.
Trial by Fire is about a guy who, it's based on a real story. And it's about a guy who is put on death row for something that he actually did not do. And it's Jack O'Connell.
Yes, I had to look up the ending, I'm afraid.
Did you see my review?
I did. I know it comes back.
Well, if you read my... Yeah, I tried to do in my review, I did a... It's a real historical event. On the other hand, it's not like Kennedy's assassination where everybody knows what happened.
What happened?
Oh, yeah. No, you can't go to Texas. It's the theme of both movies, actually. Yeah. Look out in Texas. So anyway, so in this movie, I wrote the review in such a way that you could figure it out if you read it. I watched the movie and I didn't know what happens. And so I thought I was watching a different kind of movie. And I was very frustrated by it as I was watching it because they weren't making the movie that I wanted, that I thought that they were promising me. And so this is the rare case, even though I'm not going to reveal what happens, but it is a rare case of, I think the movie's better if you know what happens. Like if you know what it's about. Because if you go in not knowing, you just watch it and you say, what's this about? What's the point of this? And this is kind of depressing.
Susan Sarandon shows up at the end, doesn't she? And
Susan Sarandon does not show up.
As a nun.
No, that wouldn't make it better. I don't think. I don't think that would make it better. And then let's see, what else did we have this week opening up?
All is not false.
Oh yeah, all is true. And you know what that one, Leva?
No,
I'll tell you all about it. Okay, All is True is Kenneth Branagh's latest movie, and it's about Shakespeare's later years. And of course, nobody knows anything about Shakespeare. They really don't know anything about Shakespeare, and they don't even know. I mean, really, they're not even sure he wrote the plays. And people say they act as though everybody's sure, but honestly, they're not even that sure. But anyway, Shakespeare returns to Stratford, and
have you ever seen the house in Stratford, by the way?
No, I've never been there.
It's just tiny little rooms.
Well,
teeny little tiny rooms.
Well, anyway, so he's 49 years old. He's retiring. He's 49 years old, and they based Branagh's makeup on a portrait of a guy who might be Shakespeare, as opposed to the one guy who definitely was Shakespeare, which is the bald guy, right? So they base him on a guy. They give him instead a guy in his 40s with a sort of slick back hair, and they give him like a head. He's practically wearing a helmet of skin, and so nothing moves. And it looks like a sort of a bozo, ridiculous thing, and he can't move his face. Then they do something with his beard that's really sharp. So he looks ridiculous. The movie, I'm not sure, but I think the movie was written by the guys who wrote Blackadder. And it seems like one little push away from it. But my favorite is the casting of Mrs. Shakespeare. I couldn't believe it. Okay, now, Shakespeare's supposed to be 49, okay? And it's played by Kenneth Branagh. Mrs. Shakespeare's played by Judi Dench. Right? Now, I know that Mrs. Shakespeare was older than Shakespeare, but she was like 56. And so they bring out Judi Dench and they put her to like make things plausible. They put her in like a red wig. And
so
it
that's
is
where you get
insane.
This inspiration for Elizabeth I, I assume.
Well, yeah. I mean, well, it's like a pale red wig as opposed to a bright red wig. But it's ridiculous. So he's there with Judi Dench. Oh, William, you've come back to the house. You've been gone for 20 years. And then she says, you may sleep in the bedroom. But just to be friends. It's so ridiculous.
I bet you're so teeny.
And you see him and it's like, I mean, the pairing of those two is ludicrous. First off, they look insane together. Then the whole story builds on how Shakespeare is grieving over his son's death. Now, admittedly, when bad things like you lose a son or something happens, you never get over it. That is true. But he's grieving over it like it just happened, and it happened 17 years earlier. The other thing that he's grieving about is that his son could have been a great writer, he thinks, based on a few poems. And this I can tell you with absolute certainty. The only people who dream about their sons becoming a great writer are people who are not writers. Because a father would not grieve over his son's lost potential as a writer. He would grieve over the kid being dead. And that's it. Because writers, people who write, know that people are so much more than the things they write, even if they're really great. Even if they're really great at it. It's sort of like my father was a great athlete before he gained 50 pounds and, you know, smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day. But he was, when he was a young man, he was actually a great athlete. He got a scholarship to go to St. John's College for basketball.
Wow.
And he was also a great...
How tall was he?
He was only 5'10".
Wow.
Yeah.
I assume he played guard.
So you're looking at me and you're saying, wow, but Toulouse-Lautrec's father was on a basketball team. How did that happen? Anyway, but my father, when I was a kid, you know, he would play sports with me, you know, do things. And he very quickly figured out that I was a stiff, that I just wasn't very good athletically. He couldn't care less because he could do it himself. And he had a completely unsentimental attitude towards this thing that he could do, because he had, even though he wasn't a professional, he had a kind of a professional's eye. A writer has that thing. The people who are sentimental about writing are not writing writers. Writing is something else. And for a father to be obsessed with his son becoming a writer is, I don't believe that for a minute. And then where they take it from there becomes more and more ridiculous. If you watch it as a comedy, it's not satisfying because there's not enough things to really snicker at. But it really is kind of bad. Yeah, it's bad.
Does he talk like Shakespeare? Does he talk with thou art ours, goest to this, or does he talk like with a regular modern day British?
I guess somewhere in between.
Thou goest,
yeah,
art thou.
It's definitely, yeah, because if you push that too far, it becomes funny. Did you see my wife's play A Beard of Avon when it was here?
Which one?
Beard of Avon.
Never saw Beard of Avon.
Oh, that was a good one. It was about Shakespeare.
Yeah, no, and I did see You Nero, and the one about the Restoration.
Oh yeah, that's
good. And the one that's the Master Builder.
Oh, so you've okay. Sorry.
I didn't see the other one. I would like to.
The reason why, because I was thinking, because of All Is True, yeah, is about Shakespeare. Okay, so we got another one. Yeah, let's see. What's the name of this thing? I'm trying to remember. It's something.
It's My Son. If you put All in front, you'd have an Arthur Miller play.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because All Is True is above it on the list, it's called Mon Garçon en français.
Garkin. Sorry, that's my French.
But it's a. I don't have to go into a whole big thing about it. The only reason why I went into a whole big thing about All Is True is because it's funny. But My Son is a solidly pretty good French thriller about a guy who's a divorced guy, gets a phone call from his hysterical wife saying their kid has disappeared while at camp. And so he has to try to find the kid. And he's an architect, but he, you know, becomes Superman, starts beating up everybody. It's kind of the usual American pattern. But what I like about it, because it's a French movie, it has some of the virtues of French movies. And by the way, French movies, they don't all have all the French characteristics. I mean, they're not all positive. There's some bad French characteristics, but I don't want to go into this. This movie has all the good French characteristics. It's very interested in human relationships. And the French have an attitude towards this kind of movie, which I wish more Americans would. They get in and they get out. They just do it. Like, for example, that horrible movie with Johnny Depp and Angelina Jolie.
The Tourist.
Horrible movie. Goes on for like 125 minutes. That movie was originally a French movie. 80 minutes long and great. Absolutely fun, great movie. And this movie is like 80 minutes long. Somebody will probably make it, you know, they'll remake it in the United States and they'll make it boring. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, that's that for this week. And then I understand that Peter saw John Wick. Next time I run into him, maybe I'll ask him about it so he can tell me what he thought of it. And Oh, hold that. Oh, I see an apparition.
Look, just came in.
I actually was just coming in here to see if Liba needed more tissue.
It's Peter Hartlob.
Needed more contact lens solution. Thank you.
I do, actually.
John Wick 3. You saw John Wick 2. In my research for John Wick 3.
we do intense research.
I did look up your review for John Wick 2, and I know you're not a fan. I love John Wick 1. That was the movie. That was one of like 3 or 4 movies that haunt me.
Yeah. Oh, what?
As much as a top 10 list should haunt any person, critic or otherwise.
Yeah.
I made my top 10 list that year and then saw John Wick and just thought it was one of the greatest action films I had seen and wish I had it there.
Oh, wow.
So I love John Wick.
I never saw the first one.
John Wick 2, not as good.
Yeah.
And I agreed with your points. As often happens, I disagree with your little man, but I agree with your points. I mean, I just think we saw the same movie, but different reactions.
Yeah, no. Sometimes, like, you see the same movie. Sometimes I'll read somebody else's review, and I'll agree with everything they say, but I just care less about the things that they cared about, either positively or negatively. So it's like, you could read my bad review and say, all right, yeah, he's right about that, but who cares? There's this other thing. Yeah. Is that like that?
Yeah, very much like that. Yeah. And Wick 3 was, you would have hated it.
Really?
Yeah. You would have hated it. John Wick 1, his dog is killed. It's very simple. His dog is killed.
Aww.
His wife had died of cancer and gave him the dog so that he could rebuild himself. And he's a hitman who's bought his way out of the hitman life. Somebody kills his dog and steals his car, and he spends the rest of the movie just destroying the mob and mafia that did that.
The way you describe it, that sounds pretty good.
It's good. It's clean. It's a lean action film. Reminds me of like a good Luc Besson type film where, you know, by the third one, it's all the things that were the world building in it have become the entire thing. And it's almost like watching, I compared it to Harry Potter. And people may disagree with that, but it's as much of a fantasy as Harry Potter. I mean, there's this colonial, it's the Continental Hotel in the middle of Manhattan, where it's a combination of like...
What street?
I'm not sure, but it's a good street. And it's a combination of like, it looks like the holodeck from Star Trek. And then other parts of it look like 15th century medieval library.
Oh. The old Americana.
And it makes no economic sense. All the hitmen go to this hotel and then kill each other. We don't know how they make money. He goes to like Tunisia and meets Halle Berry, who has these like martial arts attacking dogs. We don't know why. But all the choreography is still good. The action's good. The John Wickness of it is still good. So
it sounds great.
You would have hated it.
But I would have.
It's good that...
Yeah. Yeah, it worked out.
It worked out.
It worked out.
Win-win.
Worked out for everybody, including the readers. You know, because the people who are reading about John Wick are the people who are interested in John Wick. I mean, who saw maybe the first one or two and liked it.
Yeah.
So, all right. So, Liba, what else we did? We had a couple of big movies from weeks past, maybe that we can just mention.
One was called The Hustle.
Oh yeah, bad.
Bad.
Oh my goodness, so bad. Yeah, Rebel Wilson and Anne Hathaway.
Oh, that's the one that's the
remake
of two movies, actually.
Yeah, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels was
the
one I knew.
And the one with Marlon Brando and Michael Caine, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's the one.
No, Michael Caine was the one with
Steve Martin.
Steve Martin. What was Marlon Brando's co-star?
I don't know, because I didn't even know about it. Somebody mentioned
Olivia
to me.
Olivia or somebody like that?
Oh, Olivia, that would be good.
Somebody like that.
Yeah, well, anyway, this one is terrible.
Oh, David Niven. I think it was David Niven.
Oh, okay.
Marlon Brando and David Niven.
Oh, that would be fun. Mm-hmm. Was that a comedy?
Yeah, but Marlon Brando's not that great at comedies.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. yeah, I mean, he's funny, but he's not intentionally funny.
Yeah. But it's supposed to be a comedy.
Yeah. Well, anyway, Rebel Wilson. Rebel Wilson has been funny in movies, but usually in the capacity of a co-star. And I don't know what happened in this one, but wow, she's terrible. I mean, she's really like amazingly not funny, and enough so that you identify with Anne Hathaway, who wishes that she would disappear, and you start wishing that she would disappear from the movie. But she's supposed to be the one that you can't wait to see. I think that she was allowed by the director to just hit every comic moment with a sledgehammer to the point where it just wasn't funny. It was just overdone. The guy who directed is actually a funny comedian. You ever see the movie? You ever see the TV show The Thick of It?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. By the maker of The Veep.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I love that. Also the maker of Death of Stalin.
Right. So on Thick of It, the guy who plays Ollie, the young aide,
mm-hmm.
is the director of this. So he's a funny guy, but I don't know. He either directed her to tank the movie, or he didn't realize she was tanking the movie and let her, you know, go too far. I don't know what.
I also heard that Anne Hathaway didn't know she had to have a British accent until she arrived on set, and I hear the British accent's pretty bad.
Yeah, but I don't care about that. And she, you know, because that's all right. You know, that you can just forgive that, and I wouldn't even notice it. Mm. To me, it all, you know, I notice Brits doing American accents and notice how funny they sound sometimes, but I don't notice the other way around. But it doesn't strike me. The little accent stuff doesn't bother me. But and she's more funny than Rebel Wilson, but she doesn't have the funny role. So it's just garbage, just bad.
But then we come, and this is one I did see, so I can say
you
something.
Saw it.
It's called Long Shot.
Oh, you tell me what you think of Long Shot.
I liked it a lot. I actually tweeted out that I kind of thought it was a screwball comedy of the 21st century.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it had all the makings of being a big failure, if you think about it.
Yeah.
I
wish he would have shaved that beard.
You mean Seth Rogen?
Yeah, because he's kissing, you know, he's kissing.
But Charlize Theron is such an underrated actress. Even though she's won Oscars, people don't realize her range is
she's
really
great.
Big.
But there's something, you know, there's something about...
So we should give a plot, quick plot of it.
Oh, yeah, well, she's running for president and he's writing her speeches, basically. I mean, she's not running for president yet. She's setting up a presidential campaign and she's going on a tour as Secretary of State.
And she's pretty awful. I mean, personality wise, she's pretty like snooty and snobby.
Oh,
and
I think she's
ambitious.
Great.
I mean, that's how it's the role. That's the part she's
supposed
to
be. I like those people like that.
I know, but that's what I'm just saying. So that's sort of, you know, and he's a sweet guy who knew her when she was very young. So it's kind of
he's kind of a schlub, and she's actually somebody who could actually do something.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
I thought she was really great.
But you also see the transformation of her warming up and stuff like
that.
Well,
you know, in a sense, it's like a lot of romantic comedies. They both can learn something from each other, just like buddy pictures. They're all about people can learn things from each other, and this is set against an interesting background. She's doing this global warming tour of various countries, but she's really, in addition to trying to save the planet, she's trying to get herself elected president. But meanwhile, she's on kind of a tight leash, or actually, it would be tighter in real life, because the president in this example is a complete moron, but doesn't seem based on anybody specific except maybe the concept of moron. Odenkirk.
Bob Odenkirk.
Yeah, Bob Odenkirk. Who's, you know, he's kind of a combination of a few presidents in this, but also he's his own thing. But the one thing is that he's a former actor who played a president on television as opposed to like playing a businessman on television. And it seems like the way they talk, it seems like he's a Republican because he's in bed with there's a one news station that has like a Fox and Friends set up and it's called Wembley TV. But it's clearly like a right-wing thing. And so I don't know what Charlize Theron is doing in that administration exactly, but the political lines are not drawn, you know, that clearly. But it's sort of like a kind of a fantasy or like a riff on current American life, and that forms the background for what is essentially, in terms of structure, a pretty normal romantic comedy about people learning from each other. But it's really good.
I was laughing out loud.
I was laughing out loud too. I just wish he would have shaved the beard, just because he looks so.
I thought he looked actually pretty good for Seth Rogen, who can be very schlubby looking. And I thought he was schlubby, but not as schlubby as usual.
But he's like having a.
He kind of lost some weight here, and you know, I thought he looked kind of good.
I don't know. You know, I don't. It look, all these people in romantic comedies, they are surrogates for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean, and so they. Each person for a heterosexual audience, each one of the actors serves two functions. They're an object of fantasy to some degree, in a small way, but they're an object of, not fantasy, that's too strong a word, romantic projection for the opposite sex person. But then they are also kind of surrogates for the for their own sex. So that I'm watching this and I'm, you know, saying, oh, Charlize Theron, you know, that's a very impressive woman, you know, she is really somebody who deserves somebody great. And of course, the person she always deserves in the part of the audience where the audience psychology works, the person that she deserves is me, you know, whoever me is watching. Do you see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. But I don't think that there's a me too much there's much me participation with Seth Rogen looking like just like kind of a slob in this. But unless women like Seth Rogen, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it would be Paul Newman is my, like, you know, I should get Paul Newman in any movie he makes. Doesn't matter what movie.
Exactly. That's how it works. But, I mean, I just want Seth to, like, maybe just make a little bit of an effort, you know? just buy a, you know, a better shirt, you know, just something, you know, to just run a comb through his hair a little bit and maybe lose the beard. Maybe, you know,
I think
maybe.
The beard actually made him more handsome. Because without the beard, he kind of looks a little just schlubby-ish. More schlubby.
Well, anyway, the movie works anyway. That's just, you know, this is a very minor thing, but it's a really good movie. Anyway, so I think we've come to, you've wasted a perfectly good hour on car talk. So we're ready to go. Do you have anything to add, Leba?
I think that's about it this week.
That's about it last week.
About them Mets.
And about them Mets. How are the Mets doing?
They're not doing terrible.
Where are they?
They just won three straight, and they're like 3.5 out of first in the Eastern Conference.
Are they in second place?
They're third. The Braves are ahead of them, and then the Phillies are first.
Braves always are. All right. Well, with that in mind, we just lost them anyway. Let's we pretend they're still here. Okay. So anyway, thanks, everybody. We'll be back. And for the San Francisco Chronicle, I'm Mick LaSalle.
And I'm Leber Hertz.
You are listening to the San Francisco Chronicle. Thank you to Mick LaSalle and Leber Hertz. Our producer today is me, Peter Hartlob. Supervising producers are King Kaufman and Libby Coleman. Executive producer is Tim O'Rourke, and our editor-in-chief is Audrey Cooper. Music is Mozart Symphony 40 in G minor by Blue Dot Sessions. Read our columns and subscribe to the Chronicle at www.sfchronicle.com. Chronicle podcasts are on Apple Podcasts and other streaming services. Listen at www.sfchronicle.com/podcasts with an S.